Chapter 37. Were ornamented with prints out of the illustrated journals, and hung with festoons, and true lovers knots of tape and colored paper, and the old bodies had had a good dinner, and the old tongues were chirping and clacking away, all eager, interested, sympathizing, and one very elderly and rheumatic goody, who is obliged to keep her bed, and has, I trust, an exaggerated idea of the cares attending on royalty, said, "Poor thing, poor thing! I pity her." Yes, even in that dim place there was a little brightness and a quavering huzzah, a contribution of a mite subscribed by those dozen poor old widows to the treasure of loyalty with which the nation endows the prince's bride. 300 years ago, when our dread sovereign Lady Elizabeth came to take possession of her realm and capital city, Hollingshed, if you please, whose pleasing history of course you carry about with you, relates in his fourth volume folio, that, tea her entering the city, she was of the people received marvelous entirely, as appeared by the assemblies, prayers, welcomings, cries, and all other sins which argued a wonderful earnest lowe. And at various halting places on the royal progress children habited like angels appeared out of allegoric edifices, and spoke verses to her, "Welcome, O Queen, as much as heart can think, welcome again, as much as tongue can tell, welcome to joyous tongues and hearts, that will not shrink. God thee preserve, we pray, and wish thee ever well." Our new princess, you may be sure, has also had her Alexandrins, and many minstrels have gone before her singing her praises. Mr. Tupper, who begins in very great force and strength, and who proposes to give her no less than 800,000 welcomes in the first 20 lines of his ode, is not satisfied with this most liberal amount of acclamation, but proposes at the end of his poem a still more magnificent subscription. Thus we begin, 100,000 welcomes, 100,000 welcomes. In my copy the figures are in the well-known Arabic numerals, but let us have the numbers literally accurate. 100,000 welcomes. 100,000 welcomes. And 100,000 more. O happy heart of England, shout aloud and sing, laud, as no land sang before. And let the paean soar and ring from shore to shore, 100,000 welcomes, and 100,000 more, and let the cannons roar the joy-stunned city o'er, and let the steeples chime at 100,000 welcomes and 100,000 more, and let the people rhyme it from neighbor's door to door, from every man's heart's core, 100,000 welcomes and 100,000 more. This contribution, in 20 not long lines, of 900,000, say 900,000, welcomes is handsome indeed, and shows that when our bard is inclined to be liberal, he does not look to the cost. But what is a sum of 900,000 to his further proposal? Let all these declare it, let miles of shouting swear it, in all the years of yore, unparalleled before. And thou, most welcome wanderer across the northern water, our England's Alexandra, our dear adopted daughter lay to thine heart, Condor Andor, in future years remembered well, the magic fervor of this spell, that shakes the land from shore to shore, and makes all hearts and eyes brim o'er, our 100,000 welcomes, our 50,000,000 welcomes, and 100,000,000 more. Here we have, besides the most liberal previous subscription, a further call on the public for, no less than 150,100,000 welcomes for Her Royal Highness. How much is this per head for all of us in the three kingdoms? Not above 5 welcomes apiece, and I am sure many of us have given more than 5 hurrahs to the fair young princess. Each man sings according to his voice, and gives in proportion to his means. The guns at Sheerness from their adamantine lips, which had spoken in quarrelsome old times a very different language, roared 100 thundering welcomes to the fair Dane. The maidens of England strewed roses before her feet at Gravesend when she landed. Mr. Tupper, with the 1,000,000 welcomes, may be compared to the thundering fleet. Mr. Chorley's song, to the flowerets scattered on Her Royal Highness's happy and carpeted path. Blessings on that fair face. safe on the shore of her home dwelling place, stranger no more. Love, from her household shrine, keep sorrow far. May for her hawthorn twine, June bring sweet eglantine, autumn, the golden vine, dear northern star. Hawthorn for May, eglantine for June, and in autumn a little tass of the golden vine for our northern star. I am sure no one will grudge the princess these simple enjoyments, and of the produce of the last-named pleasing plant, I wonder how many bumpers were drunk to her health on the happy day of her bridal? As for the laureate's verses, I would respectfully liken His Highness to a giant showing a beacon torch on windy headland. His flaring torch is a pine tree, to be sure, which nobody can wield but himself. He waves it, and four times in the midnight he shouts mightily, Alexandra! And the Pontic pine is whirled into the ocean and Enceladus goes home. Whose muse, whose cornemuse, sounds with such plaintive sweetness from Arthur's seat, while Edinburgh and Musselburgh lie wrapped in delight, and the mermaids come flapping up to leaf shore to hear the exquisite music. Sweeter piper Edina knows not than Aiton, the bard of the Cavaliers, who has given in his frank adhesion to the reigning dynasty. When a most beautiful, celebrated and unfortunate princess whose memory the professor loves when Mary, wife of Francis II, King of France, and by her own right proclaimed Queen of Scotland and England, poor soul, comma entered Paris with her young bridegroom, good Peter Ronsard wrote of her, Oi cui as vu l'excellence de celle cui rend la seal de l'escus en vue, die hardiment. Content as vous messu, vous ne veris jamais chose plus belle. Asterisk, quoted in Mignet's Ife of Mary. Vous ne veris jamais chose plus belle. Here is an Alexandrine written 300 years ago, as simple as bonjour. Professor Aiton is more ornate. After elegantly complimenting the spring, and a description of Her Royal Highness's well-known ancestors the berserkers, he bursts forth, Heroes of Denmark comes, the royal bride. O loveliest rose, our paragon and pride choice of the prince whom England holds so dear, what homage shall we pay to one who has no peer? What can the bard or wildered minstrel say more than the peasant who on bended knee breathes from his heart an earnest prayer for thee? Words are not fair, if that they would express is fairer still, so lovers in dismay stand all abashed before that loveliness they worship most, but find no words to pray. Too sweet for incense. Bravo! Take our loves instead most freely, truly, and devoutly given, our prayer for blessings on that gentle head, for earthly happiness and rest in heaven. May never sorrow dim those dove-like eyes, but peace as pure as reigned in paradise, calm and untainted on creation's eve, attend thee still. May holy angels, and see, this is all very well, my dear country cousins. But will you say amen to this prayer? I won't. Assuredly our fair princess will shed many tears out of the dove-like eyes, or the heart will be little worth. Is she to know no parting, no care, no anxious longing, no tender watches by the sick, to deplore no friends and kindred, and feel no grief? Heaven forbid! When a bard or wildered minstrel writes so, best accept his own confession, that he is losing his head. On the day of her entrance into London who looked more bright and happy than the princess? On the day of the marriage, the fair face wore its marks of care already, and looked out quite grave, and frightened almost, under the wreaths and lace and orange flowers. Would you have had her feel no tremor? A maiden on the bridegroom's threshold, a princess led up to the steps of a throne? I think her pallor and doubt became her as well as her smiles. That, I can tell you, was our vote who sat in X compartment, let us say, in the nave of St. George's Chapel at Windsor, and saw a part of one of the brightest ceremonies ever performed there. My dear cousin Mary, you have an account of the dresses, and I promise you there were princesses besides the bride whom it did the eyes good to behold. Around the bride, sailed a bevy of young creatures so fair, white, and graceful that I thought of those fairy tale beauties who are sometimes princesses, and sometimes white swans. The royal princesses and the royal knights of the garter swept by in prodigious robes and trains of purple velvet, 30 shillings a yard, my dear, not of course including the lining, which, I have no doubt, was of the richest satin, or that costly innerwear which we used to read about in poor Gerald's writings. The young princes were habited in kilts, and by the side of the princess royal trotted such a little wee solemn Highlander. He is the young heir and chief of the famous clan of Brandenburg. His eyrie is amongst the eagles, and I pray no harm may befall the dear little chieftain. The heralds in their tabards were marvelous to behold, and a nod from Rouge Croix gave me the keenest gratification. I tried to catch Garter's eye, but either I couldn't or he wouldn't. In his robes, he is like one of the three kings in old Miss Sal illuminations. Goldstick in waiting is even more splendid. With his gold rod and robes and trappings of many colors, he looks like a royal enchanter, and as if he had raised up all his scene of glamour by a wave of his glittering wand. The silver trumpeters wear such quaint caps, as those I have humbly tried to depict on the playful heads of children. Behind the trumpeters came a drum bearer, on whose back a gold-laced drummer drubbed his march. When the silver clarions had blown, and under a clear chorus of white-robed children chanting round the organ, the noble procession passed into the chapel, and was hidden from our sight for a while, there was silence, or from the inner chapel ever so faint a hum. Then hymns arose, and in the lull we knew that prayers were being said, and the sacred rite performed which joined Albert Edward to Alexandra his wife. I am sure hearty prayers were offered outside the gate as well as within for that princely young pair, and for their mother and queen. The peace, the freedom, the happiness, the order which her rule guarantees, are part of my birthright as an Englishman, and I bless God for my share. Where else shall I find such liberty of action, thought, speech, or laws which protect me so well? Her part of her compact with her people, what sovereign ever better performed? If ours sits apart from the festivities of the day, it is because she suffers from a grief so recent that the loyal heart cannot master it as yet, and remains true unfest to a beloved memory. A part of the music which celebrates the day's service was composed by the husband who has gone to the place where the just and pure of life meet the reward promised by the father of all of us to good and faithful servants who have well done here below. As this one gives in his account, surely we may remember how the prince was the friend of all peaceful arts and learning, how he was true and fast always to duty, home, honor. How, through a life of complicated trials, he was sagacious, righteous, active and self-denying. And as we trace in the young faces of his many children the father's features and likeness, what Englishman will not pray that they may have inherited also some of the great qualities which won for the prince consort the love and respect of our country? The papers tell us how, on the night of the marriage of the Prince of Wales, all over England and Scotland illuminations were made, the poor and children were feasted, and in village and city thousands of kindly schemes were devised to mark the national happiness and sympathy. He bonfire on Copped Point at Folkestone was seen in France, the Telegraph says, more clearly than even the French marine lights could be seen at Folkestone. Long may the fire continue to burn. There are European coasts and inland places where the Liberty Light has been extinguished, or is so low that you can't see to read by it. There are great Atlantic shores where it flickers and smokes very gloomily. Let us be thankful to the honest guardians of ours, and for the kind sky under which it burns bright and steady. On the medal of George IV. Before me lies a coin bearing the image and superscription of King George IV, and of the nominal value of 2 and 6 pence. But an official friend at a neighboring turnpike says the piece is hopelessly bad, and a chemist tested it, returning a like unfavorable opinion. A cabman, who had brought me from a club, left it with the club porter, appealing to the gent who gave it a poor cabby, at ever so much o'clock of a rainy night, which he hoped he would give him another. I have taken that cabman at his word. He has been provided with a sound coin, the bad pieces on the table before me, and shall have a hole drilled through it. As soon as this essay is written, by a loyal subject who does not desire to deface the sovereign's image, but to protest against the rascal who has taken his name in vain. Fid. Def. Indeed. Is this what you call defending the faith? You dare to forge your sovereign's name, and pass your scoundrel pewter as his silver? I wonder who you are, wretch and most consummate trickster. This forgery is so complete, that even now I am deceived by it. I can't see the difference between the base and sterling metal. Perhaps this piece is a little lighter, I don't know. A little softer. Is it? I have not bitten it, not being a connoisseur in the tasting of pewter or silver. I take the word of three honest men, though it goes against me. And though I have given 2 and 6 pence worth of honest consideration for the counter, I shall not attempt to implicate anybody else in my misfortune, or transfer my ill luck to a deluded neighbor. I say the imitation is so curiously successful, the stamping, milling of the edges, lettering, and so forth, are so neat, that even now, when my eyes are open, I cannot see the cheat. How did? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.